Greetings, Zimbabwe, Africa, and the world. Welcome to In Conversation with Trevor, brought to you by Titan Law. I go beyond the headlines and beyond the sensational. Today, I'm in conversation with Advocate Fadzai Mahere, who is also a member of the MDC Alliance. Advocate Fadzai Mahere, welcome to In Conversation with Trevor. We've been waiting for this opportunity. Delighted to have you on board.
Thank you. Thank you, Trevor, and congratulations on a fantastic show. I'm one of those people who watches it often, and it's just so interesting to learn so much about a wide range of people. So thank you so much for filling that space.
Thank you for your kind words. Thank you for watching. Thank you for your support. Fadzai, I've been looking at your CV and totally, you know, blown away by what kind of a student you were at the University of Zimbabwe, studying your Bachelor of Laws, 8 first-class passes, a first-class honours for your thesis entitled Corporate Taxation, a critique of the legal aspects of corporate tax avoidance in Zimbabwe. You have gone on to go back to the University of Zimbabwe and teach. Tell me about what stands out for you when you contrast and you look at your time as a student and your time when you're now back teaching at the University of Zimbabwe. What stands out for you?
Thank you very much, Trevor. I'll start by looking at what life was like as a student at the University of Zimbabwe. First of all, it was such an interesting period to be Zimbabwean and also to be a student of law. It was between 2004 and 2008, which was an extremely important period for legal developments and for democracy, political developments. We watched the Public Order and Security Act get enacted, the Access to Information and Protection of Privacy Act, the Gazetted Lands Consequential Provisions Act. All these legal reforms were taking place while we're sitting in class. And we had amazing faculty to deconstruct the principles, the theory, and the spirit of the law, what the law was, what the law ought to be. And I always say to people that I'll never forget the time when Professor Maduku came to class with his head bandaged. He'd just been beaten up terribly in that, church meeting gathering that they'd had, and beaten up to a pulp. But he came back to class with amazing spirit, amazing courage, and said, you know, this is why ZANU must go, because people need to be free. And when I talk to you about constitutionalism, this is what I mean. Coming forward now to the time where I've taught at the UZ, a lot of that is still there. Amazing lecturers who spend a lot of time on these students. But obviously, I look at it from quite a different lens. And I think one of the big takeaways that I've had teaching law at the UZ is what I get to learn from the students themselves, their own insights, and being able to mold what I think are important values and principles for legal practitioners to have, the need to be excellent in terms of their delivery, the need to be thorough and to be capable. You know, you don't want to present a case for a client and the client looks at it and thinks, why should I pay for this? Or if you're doing a pro bono case, raising very interesting legal principles, I want them to have the acumen to be able to deal with it, because in Zimbabwe, developments happen so fast. You know, you're not ever going to look into a banking law textbook and see bond notes. You're not going to open a property law Roman Dutch textbook and see land reform. So there really is a need for our lawyers, who I would say are the custodians of the development of the law, to really have the right ethos to guide them and also have the competence to be able to ensure that the rule of law is never compromised, that we fight hard for justice, we fight hard for freedom, and we fight hard for fairness, and we serve our clients, we provide solutions. So it's some of those ideas that I found very important to share with my students, because the law changes every day. If you look at the number of amendments they've implemented in respect of so many laws, by the time you graduate graduate, the law could look differently, but it's about instilling the right philosophical foundations in the students. And, you know, I used my own training, I used some of my experience and my own views that I formed, you know, when I was lecturing these students. And it was so interesting to see what came back. Some agreed with me and some didn't.
Are you happy with the health of the legal profession?
The room for improvement can never be filled. I think as a profession, there is more that we can do, but there's a lot as well that we are doing right. I think in an ecosystem that's dysfunctional as Zimbabwe is, there are obviously going to be problems. And I think one of the big challenges that the profession is facing at the moment is that law schools are churning out a great number of legal practitioners, and there's not enough space to absorb everyone. So sometimes the training, the on-the-job training that happens with our legal practitioners is compromised, and sometimes bad habits are passed on. But that said, I do think a lot of lawyers are doing amazing work, and in my mind, Zimbabwe Lawyers for Human Rights stands out. You know, it's great that they're able to be on call to preserve matters of human rights where people can't always afford to pay.
Your thesis... the title of your thesis, Corporate Taxation, a critique of the legal aspects of corporate tax avoidance in Zimbabwe. There's lots of tax avoidance. Have you found that thesis applicable, or you filed it away and forgotten about it?
I found it very applicable, right. And I do some work in the Fiscal Appeals Court, some tax work. But there's some key lessons just from a macro perspective, if you'd allow me to spotlight those. There's obviously a technical difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion. Mm-hmm. So tax avoidance is when your lawyer or your accountant sits down with you and helps you look at your tax affairs and minimize your obligations. See, you know, how you can expand certain expenditure, pay things in a certain way, and arrange your affairs in a particular way so that your tax liability is reduced. Mm. On the other hand, you've got tax evasion, where people or persons, corporate or otherwise, just don't pay tax. Mm-hmm. So tax avoidance is legal, whereas tax evasion is not. And one of the things that I was looking at in my thesis is to see how companies can minimize their tax obligations lawfully. Now, why is this important? I think it's important for Treasury to get most of its money not from squeezing corporates or people to death. Mm. Because you want to leave money for people to be productive, for people to pay decent wages. So I think, you know, especially with our, you know, tax environment currently, where there is this thrust by the minister to try and tax everyone as much as he can, 2% here, 10% there, we're increasing this. We really need to look at the health of the corporate taxation sector, because if you tax people too much, that's when you get a lot of defaulting, and that doesn't
what
help.
What you're saying, Fadzai, sorry to jump in there,
okay.
Raises the issue of, should we not have a wholesale tax reform? Is this not the time? Is this not the season?
It definitely is the season. Mm-hmm. We need a wholesale tax reform, but that tax reform or transformation actually should not be done piecemeal. Mm. So it should not be an exercise that's divorced from some of the other problems that we've got in the country. Mm. So in order to have a healthy tax system where people are, you know, paying their obligations and the money makes sense, everything else has to be working as well. It doesn't help to tax corporates to death in a currency that nobody has confidence in. It doesn't help to tax people so much that they end up, you know, just folding up because the tax liability is so high. Mm. It doesn't help to have a system where, you know, the tax man can just garnish and close your account at will without due process, and companies are hamstrung from being able to trade, because, you know, it's important for an economy to be vibrant, for there to be productivity, and for businesses to be able to do what they do best, i.e. to make money so that there's more money to go around. And then, you know, that way, even though the tax liability might look less from a percentage perspective, for example, or, you know, you've got more compliance, which means more money for the fiscus, and it should be money that people believe in, real money, so to speak.
Right. I was still looking at your education, and then you went and did a master's in international law at Cambridge. And I'm struck by this thing that says you are awarded a Pegasus Fellowship from the Honourable Society of the Inner Temple in London. I'm like, wow, what does that mean?
So the bar in the United Kingdom is divided up into various inns of court.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do you just have the barristers, or what we call advocates here in Zimbabwe, but they're then divided further into groups. So the different sets of chambers or the different advocates join various groups, and it becomes a collegiate atmosphere. With your inn, that's where you get training, that's where you're called, and that's where you basically have a group of people that's different from the group of people that you go to court with. Now, they also have various international programs that they host individually as inns, and one of them was this scholarship or a fellowship for Commonwealth /ex-Commonwealth pupils who are studying at Cambridge to spend time at various sets of chambers in London for a short period. I think it was just under half a year.
Mm.
And I was very, very fortunate to be awarded that opportunity. And I think it's at that point that my decision to become a barrister or to become an advocate, as opposed to being an attorney or a solicitor, someone who deals with clients directly, was crystallized. I was exposed to the brightest and the best of, barristers in London. I learned so much. They were so forthcoming. I told our story as well as best as I could and just looked at some of the opportunities. And since then, some of those barristers have come back in various capacities to train lawyers and do other things. So
lifetime relationships have formed from
fully,
that.
Fully. And, I grew. The training was world class. And I still hold myself to global standards in terms of the delivery of the work that I do.
That's good to hear. And then you marshalled with Judge Paget. Do I pronounce it well?
Yes, Paget.
Paget. You marshalled with Judge Paget QC at Old Bailey. Old Bailey, London's oldest criminal court. Tell us about that in 2010.
It was deeply fascinating.
Yeah.
And to marshal is to just sit with a judge in court. So the judge will be seated here, and you're seated right next to him. You get to see the entire court process. Now, what was most fascinating about this is that they've got a jury system in the United Kingdom. So evidence is led in court. The judge controls the legal side of things, but the factual determination as to whether or not the killing took place, whether or not certain other factual elements took place, is decided upon by the jury. So it was a wonderful opportunity to see firsthand how a different legal tradition operates. And also, because so much of criminal work is actually advocacy, so it's not so much debating the law, but it's about extracting facts out of a witness, handling your witness, and learning how to cross-examine in a manner that's tight and will elicit the answers you like. It was an interesting way to pick myself apart and watch other lawyers in action from that vantage point and see what I could do better and learn some fantastic
anything
tricks
that
of the
we
trade.
Could copy from that to the local environment?
Absolutely. Cross-examination is cross-examination, whether it's in an impeachment hearing in the US, whether it's at the Old Bailey in London or at Rotten Row here in Zimbabwe. Short, sharp questions, structure, preparation. You have to be extremely detailed in the work that you do. So, the rules are all the same, but it was wonderful to see it all in action. And Judge Paget was so inspirational in the manner in which he conducted that court, because some of the crimes that come before them are the most gruesome murders, the most gruesome rapes.
Do we have that kind of sort of mentoring for our young lawyers within the local environment?
We do, but not in the same way. And it's something that's worth adopting.
Okay.
And the other thing that I think is very important to sort of pick from the English system is before a judge or before judges decide to apply to become judges and sit those interviews, I think it would be great for an opportunity to be given to judges to act as judges. So before you're full-time, see what it's like to be a judge. See whether it's your thing or not. Because I can imagine, I don't know, that not every judge, enjoys what they do. And not every judge has the right expectations when they come in. So it's very new for everyone. So I think mentoring both young lawyers and also lawyers that are about to become judges, just so that there's continuity in the development of the law, is one of the things that we could definitely learn. Some lawyers do excellent work in terms of the training, the mentoring. It's not always there. We can be better. And, you know, that's a word for lawyers that are at the middle and senior end of the bar, to really take time when you've got an intern or a pupil or a young lawyer to just try and help them. Because a lot of becoming good as a lawyer is received wisdom. You've got a great trainer.
Passed on skills.
Yes.
And then you've done legal research at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, based in Arusha, Tanzania, given the Rwanda genocide. What one or two things made an impression on you there?
The first thing, and this is directly relevant to the Zimbabwean context, is that when something as grave as a genocide takes place in your country, don't whitewash it. Mm. Don't pretend it didn't exist, didn't happen. Don't gloss over the trauma, because it always comes back. I think one of the key lessons to draw is that even though Gukurahundi happened in the early 80s, the trauma still lives amongst us. There's been no truth telling, there's been no justice, there's been no accountability for the victims. Rwanda has done that extremely well. Not to say that all the issues are resolved, not at all, but they really are taking great strides to try and resolve that problem, because you don't want it to ever come back. And it does, because these sentiments fester amongst us. You know, you don't want a whole ethnic group to feel left out and not included, because you cannot then take the country forward.
As you're talking now, I'm having goosebumps, and I'll tell you why. I visited the Rwanda Museum.
The memorial.
Memorial for genocide. And I can hear, as you're talking now, the screams of people that went in there and visited. So I completely identify
with what you said. We need that. And you'll recall from the memorial.
We
do need to mourn. We need to mourn. Because if you remember, inside the memorial, there are all those dead bodies. They didn't tamper with the smell. Just so that people always remember that this happened and it should never happen again. We haven't had that in Zimbabwe. You know, some people actually deny whether or not Gukurahundi took place. That's unacceptable from a transitional justice perspective, from an international law perspective, but even from a nation-building perspective. And these things, regardless of who then comes in, Trevor, will always come back.
I remember seeing shoes, small shoes.
Hopefully, little kids. And in Zimbabwe, there's one photograph that sticks with me all the time of the little toddler who's grabbing his mother. She's dead. You know, imagine where that child is now, what sort of trauma they carry. Even if you look at the underdevelopment that happens, and I mean, I do education, Matabeleland, the schools there are the worst. When Mugabe died, a lot of people said, oh, we've got a fantastic education system. A lot of people further down south said, you know what, we never tasted the so-called good education system. So that really needs to be addressed. And one of the things that I found really poignant when I was at the ICTR was that there was a genuine attempt, and I underline genuine attempt, to sincerely, using an independent, impartial mechanism that's open to scrutiny, to try and bring those responsible to book. To say that this is unacceptable, you can't do this. People were named. It didn't matter that you were the Minister of Information, that you're the Minister of Media during the time, because they used a lot of music and the media was very big during the Rwanda genocide.
Hate speech.
Hate speech, you know, that sort of language. Mm. That has to go down on record. It has to be dealt with. And they did a great job without fear and without favor.
And you then worked on another very important case, worked on the case against Jean-Pierre Bemba of the DRC. What were your key takeaways there? That is at the International Criminal Court at The Hague in Netherlands. What were the key learnings and takeaways?
Now, the key learnings in that case are a bit different, and they're now a little bit technical, coming to the actual law. You know, you obviously are aware that Jean-Pierre Bemba got acquitted in the end. After serving a bit of time and so on. After having, obviously, he was tried while in custody. There's a need for international criminal tribunals and international mechanisms to ensure that they're not too divorced from the victims and the societies that they're meant to serve and for whom justice should be brought. there's a need to ensure that the system either updates itself to ensure that investigations are transparent and thorough. Because having worked on the trial myself, I think more could have been done by the prosecution to ensure that the case was watertight. Because as should happen in every legal system, you know, the accused person's rights in the International Criminal Court are extremely strong. So you don't want your case to fall apart because of weak prosecution. You don't want your case to fall apart because the lawyers that are handling the matter don't have the context. You really want to ensure that that's good. And I think the clarion call is that as Africans, we need to come up with our own mechanisms to enforce international criminal law. We must not outsource this responsibility. And those mechanisms must be sincere. We shouldn't, as the African Union or African Justice, the collective, create institutions which we know are doomed to fail, like happened with the SADC tribunal. You know, we should ensure we've got our own mechanisms. We can take, you know, control of the process and ensure that victim is that justice is done for victims.
So there's people that say, you know, Africans, let's do away with the ICC. But does Africa have the capacity and the willingness, the political willingness, to create an institution that would hold former leaders to account?
Now, I'm not a fan of removing the ICC with the way Africa is currently, because like you say, there's very little political will to deal with those who are accused of some of the worst offences. And, you know, they're the ordinary criticisms that come up in SADC, that it's an old boys club, they just protect each other, so on. So we're not yet ready. Do we have the capacity? Absolutely, yes. We've got some of the finest lawyers in Africa. We've got some of the finest judges in Africa. And if they're allowed to operate independently, coming back to the rule of law and the importance of that as a value, if they're allowed to do their work, if prosecutors are allowed to do their work to investigate without any sort of impediment, the cases won't fall apart. But if we have what happened in Kenya, where the system is deliberately acting to forestall the prosecution to ensure that it doesn't work, if we then have that in Africa, then impunity will continue. So there's a need to introspect in Africa. There's a lot of conflict. There are a lot of human rights abuses that really meet the threshold of gravity for crimes that are tried before the International Criminal Court. But we do not have an answer to how do we deal with that. So, of course, when they're trying al-Bashir, they'll say, but Africa is not doing anything. You know, the difference with, for example, those responsible for the Iraq war is that they'll say, from a complementarity perspective, our jurisdictions will deal with these people should the need be. They'll conduct their commissions, and there is some sort of attempt to do justice. So as Africa, we need to introspect. Our attitude towards international criminal justice on our soil has to become more sincere and more robust.
And lastly, your journey then takes you to, again, within the ICC at The Hague, to work as a lawyer investigating the Kenyan situation, which is very relevant given to our history of post-election violence. What were your key takeaways and learnings from that, and applicability to our local situation?
Now, I think that case has got, you know, so many mirrors, so much rhyming with the Zimbabwean one, where you've got widespread systematic post-election violence, you know, widespread displacement of persons, lots of rapes and so on. I think, again, after that happened, even though the case before the International Criminal Court was not successful, having the case in that forum forced the Kenyans to the table in a very genuine way. They reformed their entire judiciary. They didn't just take the odd judge here, the odd judge there, and say, look, let's do some patchwork reform. They completely transformed the system. That's the new judiciary that then overturned an election. So I think the key learning is that we really need to come to a point where, given the trauma and the crises we've experienced as a country, we come to a national consensus about what should never be allowed to take place again from a democratic perspective. Violence. We cannot, after the trauma of 2008 that nobody speaks about again, after the trauma of Muramba China, after the trauma of Gukurahundi, I cannot for the life of me understand why it should ever be acceptable for army tanks to drive in our streets and to shoot citizens arbitrarily. It's that failure to resolve crises and conflicts and breaches of fundamental human rights that leads us to the continued same place. That's why our institutions are not transforming in the way that can achieve sincere nation building.
Correct me if I'm wrong, the Kenyan situation, am I right that this whole pressure, this whole ICC pressure, actually resulted in a local solution?
Yes.
To a Kenyan problem.
Fully.
Which is what we don't have here.
Yes, which is what we don't have here. And you know what's unfortunate, Trevor?
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like there is a need for things to escalate to a point where people are then forced to this crisis at the table. Why can't we just look at Zimbabwe today as it stands and say, look, this is not who we are. You know, 18-hour load shedding is not who we are. The failure to provide clean potable water is not who we are. Hyperinflation is not who we are. This lack of democratic freedoms is not who we are. This suffering, this, you know, failure, closure of hospitals, honestly, in 2019, cannot be the Zimbabwe that we want. And we always tell ourselves we're so educated, we're so competent, we go around the world and we shine. And yet these very basic building block daily issues that people face are not resolved. Let's not wait until there's a war in Zimbabwe.
What's wrong with
us? To come to the table.
What is wrong with us? Or am I blaming the victim?
You're blaming the victim. What's wrong is right at the top, Trevor.
Okay.
It's right at the top with our leadership. These are people who claim, and I'm going to speak as a post-liberation young woman, you know, after the war, born in 1985, where the promise of liberation and independence was so strong. What has become of that? They say they went to the war to liberate Zimbabwe. They have to ask themselves today, is this the liberation that they fought for? They fought for a united Zimbabwe, where black people, white people could all sit together, where black people do not suffer. They started with the right rhetoric, Gutsaru Jinji, yet people are now facing a crisis of starvation. It's the people at the top that are toxic. And unfortunately, it's just a few drops of poison that then pollute the entire ecosystem. They need to resolve, there has to be a national consensus. And what the people down below can do, what we the citizens, the opposition can do, is to really hold them to account. Speak out strongly, ask the right questions, speak and act.
Are we holding them to account?
You know, a lot of work is being done. More can be done. I appreciate that. But I think if you just look at the 2018 election, people did vote. It's not as though people were apathetic. You know, people, you know, were very clear about some of the demands that they wanted, the sort of politics that they wanted to see. And people speak themselves whores about the power crisis every day, saying, look, how is there corruption? A solar project is paid for by me as a taxpayer. It never comes to fruition and there's no accountability anywhere. It's just gaslighting and lies. We've got a fuel crisis. How do you not have fuel and petrol stations for 2 years nonstop and nobody in government is flinching? Unacceptable. We had hyperinflation just a decade ago. It should be seared in everybody's mind what happens where we introduce a Zim dollar without the fundamentals. And yet here we are. That's not the old gogo who's vending. That's not the teacher at fault. That's not the doctor at fault. That's not the young student who's trying to aspire for better. That is the people at the top. It's a failure of our leadership. And I have to say the government has failed. Let's not even beat about the bush. And, you know, sometimes people accuse us of dog whistling. No, there's no code. Quite directly, we have to say they have failed.
I was going to ask you what made you join to politics, but I think you've just answered it. I can see the passion. I can see the lawyer in you. But still, having looked at your career, where you are right now, seeing this passion, you've just come in from the courtroom right now. What is it that eventually say to you, I need to get into politics?
Now, I'll start from why I came back to Zimbabwe. So I remember it was in 2011 where I took on the Pegasus Fellowship and I spent time in chambers in London, and eventually a fork in the road emerged where I had a choice between staying in London, converting my degree and continuing as a barrister in London, or coming back to Zimbabwe to be part of the legal system here. I remember thinking thinking to myself, saying, you know, there's so much attraction here in London. Everything works. You know, you're surrounded by the brightest and the best. I can become the sharpest ever. But I also said to myself, you know, the ceiling is very clear. It's hard enough when you're not a local in a place where it's not home to live a life of impact and meaning. Yes, you'll make the money, but will you be able to actually make a difference to people's lives? And at the time, the Constitution was in the process of being made. It was such an interesting and exciting time for a young lawyer in Zimbabwe. You know, the currency had stabilized, and we really must thank the Minister of Finance at the time for what he did there. Because as a young professional, it made sense to come back to Zimbabwe, and you could actually pick Zimbabwe over London. You could pick Harare. You know, so I came back because I wanted to make a difference and to be part of Zimbabwe, which I always say is a success story waiting to happen. Sometimes there are twists and turns and the chapters, some are too long. Sometimes, you know, the bad guy's winning for too long. But you know that Zimbabwe's got all the ingredients for success. We're not like other post-conflict African societies. Everything we need to succeed is actually here. So I decided to come to Zimbabwe, and everything was going well for a while. At least we were on a path during the GNU. You know, there was a little bit of stability of the currency. In fact, there was stability of the currency, even though there was still work being done on the macroeconomic fundamentals. There was a sense that the country was going forward. Businesses were starting to thrive, and young people had an energy. There was something in the mood of the country at the time that was extremely exciting, and you wanted to be a part of it. I decided to come back home. Then 2016 happened, the introduction of bond notes. And just because the memory of 2008 was seared in my mind, you know, nobody was spared during that time. Everyone lost their savings. Everyone had to start afresh. Everyone was at that point where there was nothing in the shelves. Things were extremely tough. We must never forget that time. You know, Zimbabweans tend to, we suffer from, you know, forgetfulness. We forget things. But let's remember 2008. And I said to myself, you know what? They're introducing a bond note. They're calling it an export incentive. Problem number one, it's not provided for at law. Now, the minute something is illegal, you've got a problem because the law exists for a reason. Second of all, they want to introduce a Zimbabwe dollar. What is it backed by? And then they pretended for a little bit that, you know, it was backed by an export incentive. But we asked to see the details of the facility from Afrex and Bank. They were not publicly available, as would be expected. Dealing with something as fundamental as the monetary system, you can't just do that behind closed doors. There has to be transparency, and the public needs to be, you know, given notice and an opportunity to really make representations. None of that took place. I saw that we had a problem. And I kept quiet, and I remember saying to a few lawyers, look, guys, this is not legal. You flip through your Banking Act, your Bills of Exchange Act, all your legislation. There's no legal support for it. What I then did, I was still teaching at the University of Zimbabwe, was I wrote a blog on the illegality of the bond note. And I said to my students, you know, because it had just come out in the Herald announced, and I said, look, is this legal? Because one of the important facets of administrative law is to test the legality, the rationality, and the fairness of government conduct. And I wanted it to come alive for them because it's important to create lawyers that are practical and that can adapt to new situations. And I said, you know what, I'm going to put out an opinion. Let's debate it tomorrow. Feel free to disagree. If there's an act of parliament that I've left out, by all means, go into it and we'll discuss it. They read my opinion. They're like, oh, ma'am, yeah, no answer. And I was like, oh, okay, maybe it's just students, you know, not reading into things, and we keep debating it. Next thing, newspapers picked up the blog and reproduced it, and a whole conversation began. And I was privileged, this coincided again with this flag. The need for citizens to act. Don't outsource your obligation to hold the government to account to anybody. Not to me, not to Pastor Ivan, not to Chamisa. You as an individual really have to always monitor your councillor, your MP, your presidium. And I, from nowhere, I had no formal authority whatsoever, started saying, you know what, this is illegal. This is illegal and it cannot continue. We know what's going to happen. It's going to lead to hyperinflation. This is going to collapse. And I remember Mangujge at the time came up with all sorts of, you know, he got his churches, he did his business breakfasts, but he really could not answer the question on the legality. let alone the other questions as well. And then, you know, I started getting involved with this flag. I was like, you know what? And Pastor Ivan, I really must, you know, very publicly thank him, because I'm not a typical politician in this space. It wasn't typical for someone like me, at least at the time that I entered. In 2000, maybe things were different, but young people were just not involved in politics at all before Ivan came in. And there was this awakening and this real push to hold the government to account. Where the success lay is the fact that the government, having made the announcement in May and wanting to introduce bond notes then, had to delay in October because they had this very big question to answer. And I think 3 years down,
thanks to your pioneering work,
we are vindicated. Well, there were lots of people who were involved, a lot of people who protested. I have a whole team that sat in a park and were arrested just for saying that bond notes would do exactly what they've done and that everything was a lie. A lot of people stood up. And again, the indictment lies with the people at the top, because you cannot blame the people on the question of the bond notes. People spoke out, people asked, people acted, people protested, people took to the street. You know, as a leader, what do you want people to do? You want people to die in their masses so that you remain with the country alone? You really have to introspect, because leadership is about the people. Politics is about the people. And the minute you take the people out, you remain with a hollow shell.
Then you got involved, like you said, with this flag. So that was your baptism of fire.
Yes, my
rite of politics,
passage.
Rite of passage. And you then decided that you would be an independent candidate. And the question I have for you is, you clearly had looked left, right and center and decided what went through your mind.
So when I was involved with this flag with a whole team of very amazing people, one thing we noticed is that it's one thing to speak as a citizen. We can all write very long articles, we can all tweet, we can all write on Facebook about what's wrong. But if the people who are then empowered at law to make the decisions about our lives are not listening, if they're not competent, if they're not using the power they have, then we really are saddled with a very big problem. And we, as activists, became very critical of the political system and said, you know, they're not talking to us, they're not engaging, they're not finding solutions. Our daily issues, it's always about partisan politics, but they're never dealing with our daily issues. And I come back to that. The daily issue that the Zimbabwean faces, whether it's hospitals, whether it's failure to put food on the table, failure to take kids to school, soaring prices, lack of fuel, lack of zest, that's what politics should be about. Issue-driven, issue-based, issue-based politics. You must solve those problems before you send people to space, before you set up a space satellite. And I remember saying, you know, and we had this flag Thursday, which was an online television show where we would sit people down, and we had a wide range of people, politicians from both sides, ministers from both sides, and we'd ask them questions. We were shocked at the caliber of the people who were in charge. We could not for the life of us, you know, just think that, look, these are the people running things. Just the lack of competence, the lack of concern, the lack of, you know, solution building, the lack of just even care, you know. How does a crisis get to a point where, you know, there are no water treatment chemicals in the country? You've got no ZESA, and it's business as usual. They sit in cabinet and they deliberate. You're like, what are you deliberating about? This country is broken. It's dysfunctional. And so we said to ourselves, you know what? The problem is actually the politics. The issues everyone can see and the citizens are doing the most. But the problem is our broken political system. Now, we were extremely naive and jaded in a good way. We came into politics with an open canvas. And I remember us, after, you know, doing this flag for a while and realizing that, you know, people will always ask, so what now and what's the solution? We said, you know what? Let's run for political office. And let's run such a clean campaign that everyone will be like, yes, we do have faith in politics. Because the answer we consistently got when we're doing this flag was, politics doesn't work. Politics is broken. Elections don't work. We said, you know what? If we run a campaign that can energize the young, that can inspire hope and a thirst for change. If we can be all the things, maybe we're demanding too much. Maybe they think we're asking for too much when we ask for hope, accountability, and development. Why don't we, you know, start to activate people and say, look, if you can be the change you wish to see in the political system, you'll come some way in achieving the solution. And so the Yellow Campaign was born.
What a fantastic campaign.
Thank you.
I mean, that's one of the best political campaigns I've seen in a long time. What were the main lessons from that campaign for you?
That's a great
question. You didn't win the election, but what were the main lessons for you?
I think, and I have to first say thank you to the team that supported me. Mm. I have to say thank you to every person who put in money, every person who supported us in kind, every single person who voted for us. You know, I don't regret that year. And, you know, I got in thinking I'd change things, but I came out changed myself. And the key lesson, Trevor, because having conducted a long outreach before issuing out our manifesto, we'd gone to the people and said, what do you want to see in politics? And they told us all the things, the swimming pools, the libraries, the engaged politics councils. You know, you want people to hold, you know, held to account. You want a strong parliamentarian who comes back, who champions development, but who also talks about the law. We answered all your questions and we actually went to people and said, look, every single promise we made, we answered. Why then? Why would you not back this horse? And they said, you know what, Fazai, everything was great. But what we really wanted was someone who could be part of a team that could answer the national question. Hmm. So we didn't want someone who was just doing some local level work. We wanted to be part of a team because, you know what? Our daily issues, our daily struggles are national. Hmm. It's the decisions right at the top that are wrong, and we need a whole team. Hmm. We need you to collaborate. We need you to come together with the others. Uncomfortable as that might be for all sorts of reasons, but we need you to join with everyone else and then lend your voice from there so that we're backing one horse. Mm. They said they wanted to see in our body politic a strong, united opposition. Mm. And the lesson that we got from the people is precisely the lesson we took from our campaign.
You say, Fazai, as uncomfortable as that might be, to join the others. What does that mean?
That means that if I'm in charge of a campaign, I've got all sorts of license to do everything that I want. If you're running a campaign in Mount Pleasant, it's so much easier than having to, you know, go to every single demographic and answer the questions that people have, to collaborate, to bring together different people with different skills. If I had a bright idea on the Yellow Campaign, I'd just wake up and say, let's do this. Mm. Sometimes it would fail and we'd be like, oh, let's move on. But when you're now part of a bigger team, you now have to work with other people. And this is a good thing. It's uncomfortable only in the sense that, you know, processes are a lot more elaborate, but for good reason, because that's how you achieve the national consensus and can, you know, answer the national question. Also, I have to say that, you know, at the time that we decided to run, it wasn't as easy to just join, for example, the opposition. I was never going to join ZANU-PF, Trevor. I'm not ZANU-PF. I've never been ZANU-PF. Mm. And I believe the model is completely wrong. Mm. You know, they're not the party that can take us into the future. So the only place that I could sort of fit was going to be the MDC, but there was no
sort
space.
Of fit.
Sort
Talk
of fit
that.
Because they had very tight rules around who could run as MP.
Okay.
They had their primary elections, and justifiably so. Mm. You don't just waltz into a political party without following the processes. And remember, we were midstream with the campaign, you know. So the day we decided we're going to run, within a month, we'd set everything up. Mm. But if you're going to join a big political party, you have to respect what they've built over 20 years. You can't just launch and say, I've got a big, bright idea. I'm bright and shiny.
Move over.
Move over. You know, you have to respect what's there already. Mm. And we did try and write to the alliance, the MDC alliance, and say, look, can we work together? And justifiably so, you know, they didn't come back to us. And I now understand it's because their rules simply did not allow for that. It would set a dangerous precedent. Mm. But what I knew then was that we needed to align ourselves with people who were opposed to the current system that's broken the country over decades. Mm. And, you know, we said to ourselves, look, the worst that can happen is that we don't win. And if we don't win, we will learn. And learn we did.
You did.
And we also learned the importance of going to talk to the people. Getting a strong sense of what people's needs are. You know, bringing communities together to drive change. You know, divorcing ourselves sometimes from the technical stuff that's talked about in the newspapers and really coming down to people.
Grassroot
where
level.
They are, grassroots level, and hearing. And you know, there's nothing as fulfilling as people believing in an idea that you set up.
And then November 2017 yes. happened. There was a lot of excitement.
Yes.
People went onto the streets, took selfies with soldiers. You participated in that.
Yes, I did.
Do you regret it?
So people took to the streets for different reasons. Mm. Let's start there. When I took to the street, it was because I was sick and tired of Robert Mugabe, who had been the symbol of my and the entire country suffering for so long. So the minute people said there is a protest to complain against Robert Mugabe, I was there. And I don't regret that. And there was a changed mood in the country at that time. I don't think there's any escaping that. We went out to march to say, look, we want a different Zimbabwe. We want the symbol of our oppression. We want Robert Mugabe to fall. Those were the clear messages that were sent out. And, you know, the sense that I certainly had was that everything around us was propping Robert Mugabe up. You know, remember in 2008 when SADC came into the country after the post-election violence, Thabo Mbeki himself flew in. After people's hands have been chopped off, after there's widespread and systematic
crisis,
violence everywhere,
what crisis?
He said there is no crisis in Zimbabwe. That's a slap in the face from the region. You know, so, you know, you almost felt like you're alone as Zimbabweans. This flag flares up and the region doesn't even know. People don't see that. Look, people are desperate for change. You know, so when the space to have a protest came up, we're like, you know, we're the country where people can't protest.
So the protest was not an endorsement of
certainly
the coup.
Certainly not an endorsement. Firstly, of Emmerson Mnangagwa. I've never endorsed him. I've never believed in him. I didn't think he'd fail so spectacularly and as soon as he did. But I never endorsed because, like I said, ZANU-PF is rotten to the core. The model can never take us into the future. And I think the mistake that we made as citizens is twofold. The first being that we thought that if the symbol of our oppression, Robert Mugabe, fell, then that would be the end of our problems. We underestimated just how large the system that's been created over time and perfected by ZANU-PF was. The second mistake is we should have, and this is a regret, and this, you know, I strongly regret, we allowed there to be infractions of the Constitution.
Right.
Because of the sense of populism, the sense of falling, we were like, by any means, he must fall.
The excitement, the euphoria.
And I think that's a cautionary tale to me, to everyone. Never abandon the Constitution. To the extent that we abandoned the Constitution during that time, we made a huge mistake. But going out onto the street to exercise what is my democratic right to protest Mugabe, that I don't...
You don't regret.
I don't regret that at all. And I... Sorry.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Let's move on now to you. You then decide that you're going to join MDC, having campaigned as an independent. Take us through your mind. What led you to make that decision?
Thank you. I think the first thing is election night. I had a fantastic team of people who came in to help us as election agents, and we had every single V11 for every single polling station in our constituency. And I'll never forget...
In Mount Pleasant,
yes. Everyone who was walking in through the door, and we were waiting from about 11 p.m. to about, you know, 6 in the morning when the last polling agent from our team came in. I'll never forget the looks on their faces. Their shoulders were down. They'd come in, you know, I've come in from Vainona. I've come in from Northwood, you know. And I remember I had one team member called Sean, and he was doing the Excel spreadsheet of the results. And he's like, you know what, Fitzai, don't worry. This is like midnight now. Maybe we'll get a windfall at the barracks. And you know, in your head, you know that it's not going to happen. So by about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, I knew we weren't going to win. And the sense of disappointment amongst a team that had given everything for a year was overwhelming for me as a leader. I said to myself, gosh, I failed these guys. I had the perfect team and we didn't succeed, because I'll be honest, losing sucks. And social change is about first taking power and then using that power to drive change. So you can have all the ideas in the world and all the goodwill. If you don't take power legitimately, then you're not going anywhere. So after that, I remember sitting down with the team and saying, look, we're not going to have a meeting for a month. Let's think about it. Let's rest. Let's go and talk to people, and then we'll come back after a month. And after the month, we came back and we said, you know, we need to continue with our community projects. Mukando, for example, is still going strong in the constituency. But are we going to run again, and what shape are we going to take? And we parked that decision. We're like, you know what? As always happens, things will become clearer. And then a few conversations happened between Nelson Chamisa and myself. And, you know, it wasn't like an overnight decision. You know, he came and I said yes. We had to set out clear parameters both ways about how we would work together. And I think the core thing that we agreed on was that without a strong united opposition, we cannot take the country forward. We cannot fight this monster called ZANU-PF. So we sat down, we talked, we threshed out, you know, I set out some conditions, I think the party set out theirs, and we said, look, let's work together. At the end of the day, what's in our hearts is Zimbabwe. That's what we want to fight for, you know. We don't have to do that on different ends. We're singing from the same hymn sheet. Let's fight together. And then, you know, I joined the party and I was appointed as the Education, Sport and Culture
Have you
Secretary.
Been fully accepted as somebody coming from the outside? Fully embraced?
I feel very happy. And the first thing I want to point out is to say, you know, I am learning so much. You know, you run one election campaign and you think you know things. You don't, you know. The MDC doesn't do everything right. And I think even the party has accepted that we're on a growth path right now. But there are some things that they do extremely, extremely well. And I'm privileged, such as being able to mobilize the grassroots, such as being able to, you know, speak to people right at the bottom, hear what their concerns are and bring them together. When people come to rallies and meetings at the MDC, it's not because they want a T-shirt or a bag of maize. They believe in the cause. And getting people right from the bottom to believe in that way. Obviously, we have to be responsible now about how we channel that, especially in the environment that we have that's so dangerous. But, you know, that's a key lesson. The second key thing is that there is a strong desire to create a new Zimbabwe. And there is space to take on new ideas. The fact that I could be taken on is testimony to the fact that they're allowing new people in. You know, I had an issue with the way they treated women during the campaign, but the fact that a woman can come in, and I haven't had problems so far, and when they arise, I'll be the first to speak about it, because, you know, principle and values matter. You know, the fact that people are listening, and the things that you're learning from different portfolios, you know, the need to act on local authorities and the creation of mechanisms to hold those to account, all of those are things, you know, when you're working as part of a team, Trevor, you know, it certainly is give and take. And I think I've by and large been accepted. I'm certainly having a great time.
That's good to hear. That's good to hear. There's a conversation around, should we have a national dialogue? Should there be a political dialogue? Should Nelson Chamisa and Emmerson Mnangagwa be getting together to have a conversation? Where do you sit as far as that is concerned?
My answer is that there are no quick fixes to change. Dialogue for dialogue's sake is not going to take us anywhere. And I think evidence that quick fixes don't work in resolving our problems as a country is, number one, the government of national unity, is the coup. It's not going to be just a quick strung together arrangement that's going to take Zimbabwe forward. Zimbabwe needs to be transformed from the root. There has to be a genuine will, especially from those who are in power right now. Those that say they fought for our liberation, they really need to sit down and introspect and say, is this the Zimbabwe that we took to war for? So many of our colleagues passed on and died for Zimbabwe. Would they be proud if they were to look at Zimbabwe right now?
Are we not, that's the second time you're asking that question. Are we not beyond that? Because clearly I want us to posit to you that they are no longer doing it for the people. They are no longer doing it for the reasons that they went to the liberation struggle. They're doing it because there's something in it for them. And what you are, the important question that you're asking is a question that says to them, reform yourself out of power. That's not going to happen.
Well, I'll say three things, Trevor. The first is that, of course, it's still relevant because it's those people who fought the war who continue to hold the country hostage. Mm. They say that if you didn't fight the war, you cannot rule Zimbabwe. Mm. You're just a kid if you're 40 years old, even though, we see that even a 34-year-old woman is running Finland. Mm. So they hold us hostage and they refuse to relinquish power. So that conversation is still relevant. It's also relevant because I think, like many Zimbabweans, that war of independence is important. It's a significant part of our history. And a lot of Zimbabweans care about values, principles. You go back to the underlying values that you made people, lose their lives, take to the bush, leave their families. The number of people who died is huge. So we cannot just wish that away and say that doesn't matter. We have to make them account from a values perspective. Is this the liberation you fought for? The second thing is they say they won't reform themselves out of power. And I've heard that said numerous times. Mm. Now, we mustn't as citizens or as the opposition or citizens and the opposition together make the mistake of believing that Zimbabwe can never change, that we can never have a different government. It may take time, change is slow and sluggish, but it will come. Ian Smith said, never in 1,000 years will there be black majority rule. Here we are. Mm. Mugabe said and believed that he'd rule from the grave. Yet here we are. No bad thing lasts forever. Mm. And it's a matter of time. They might hold us hostage. It might take time for us to come to the right strategy to remove them. But eventually it's going to happen. And I think it's an indictment on a party that calls itself a liberation party, that they hold people in prison. That they imprison people with poverty, with hunger, with corruption, with injustice, with the lack of freedom. Mm. How can the same police officers that, the same styles of policing that were used during colonialism still be used now? The same legislation. MOPA echoes not only apartheid legislation, but the old Law and Order Maintenance Act. Mm. They have failed.
The sanctions issue has divided us as a nation. There are those that say sanctions should stay, those that say sanctions should go. Where do you sit as far as that issue is concerned?
Thank you, Trevor. And where I sit is here. You cannot use sanctions as a scapegoat for failure. So you cannot say that we're in this crisis because of sanctions. And the reason I say this is because a lot of money has been lost to corruption in Zimbabwe. $3 billion was lost to Command Agriculture. Now imagine if that $3 billion was used to make us more prepared for the drought that has now come. Would there be starvation? No. So the starvation was not caused by the sanctions. It was caused by maladministration, by corruption, by poor management. And I think there's a need not only to just reform, because reform is tinkering with a few things. We need to transform Zimbabwe, fix it at its root, and it's not an international issue. We need to huddle up and say none but ourselves. Let's fix the internal stuff, because attacking the problem at a sanctions level is to start really right at the top. You need to start from the bottom. Once we transform for our own benefit, once we align our own laws with our constitution for our own sake, everything else will fall into place.
Where do you stand?
To answer your question, where do I stand on sanctions is, once we do all that, the sanctions will be removed. They must be removed. Mm. But we have to do the heavy lifting that's necessary for them to be removed. So, not for them.
Yeah,
but for us,
absolutely. But in the interim, they are hurting us.
Yes.
Granted, the $3 billion stolen from agriculture through Command Agriculture is hurting the people. At some point, one would think that would say, to use your wording, let's huddle up as Zimbabweans and resolve this issue, and concede that the sanctions in the interim are hurting our efforts to huddle up. What's your view on that?
My view is that it's not the sanctions that are hurting us, Trevor. Mm-hmm. It's the corruption. It's the maladministration. Mm. It's the poor handling of the monetary crisis. you recall that GNU period that I spoke of. You know, the sense of optimism was huge. Sanctions had not been removed at that point. Let's do good by our people. Mm. Let's fix the country. Mm. Let's invest in health, you know, because I find these sanctions so odd that they don't stop the president from flying his private jet. They don't stop Chiwenga from getting health care in China. They don't stop them from getting baton sticks and paying police officers and buying tear gas. They don't stop them from, you know, shrinking freedoms. And yet they're somehow blamed for our crisis. It's not sanctions that are to blame. Mm. You know, it's the corruption, it's the bad governance disease that dogs this government that's caused us to get where we are. And so if it's about huddling up, we don't start with Z, we start with the ABC. Mm. The ABC is the necessary transformation and reformation and rethinking of these institutions, flushing out all the toxins and coming back to a place where we've got solid foundations based on constitutional democracy to take the country forward.
Fadai, if you had an opportunity, and I'm going to give you the opportunity right now, to speak directly to President Mnangagwa, what would you say to him?
If you are listening, Mr. President, the first thing that I would like to say is that, you know, the people of Zimbabwe are suffering. They're suffering from hunger, hospitals are closed, there's no power. Prices are going up, we're suffering from hyperinflation. We need to come to a point where the corruption stops. Stop allowing ministers to continue stealing. Let's come up with a new national consensus where we want to build genuinely. You squandered the goodwill that existed in November 2017. Can we now take a step back and put the country first for once? The opposition wants the best for Zimbabwe. Stop treating us like enemies. Stop killing people on the street. Stop killing the economy. Let's take Zimbabwe forward. Please comply with the constitution, align laws to the constitution, and sincerely, you know, allow people to have the freedoms that are contained in that constitution, because you are hurting us. ZANU-PF is hurting us. And so we really call upon you to introspect. And on all the decisions that you make, whether it's on the decisions regarding a dialogue, regarding the budget, how you're going to spend money, the laws that you're going to assent to, put the people first. Liberation means people must be free. And yet, currently, everybody is walking around in chains created by you.
Thank you for that very powerful and emotive message. Wow. What books are you reading at the moment?
Great question, Trevor. I'm reading two and I'm in between a third. 12 Rules of Life by Jordan Peterson. I'm reading it for a second time. Not because I agree with everything that Jordan Peterson says, but because I like testing my ideas about the world. Mm. Another book that I'm reading, this might fascinate you, is What Happened? By Hillary Clinton.
Oh, wow. Okay.
She is one of the women who inspires me, but her campaign went very wrong. Mm. It's important to see why, as a woman in politics, that would be important. And then finally, Becoming, that's the one that I've just completed, by Michelle Obama. And, you know, why I like that book is that it tells Barack Obama's story so well.
Beautiful
and,
book.
And beautiful. Mm. And how hope and inspiration can really achieve transformation in the psyche of a nation. Mm. So those are the three books that I'm reading right now.
Fantastic, fantastic. Advocate Fadai.
Thank you so much for having me, Trevor. Have a Merry Christmas if we don't see each other before
you,
then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What an inspirational story. That's, I've no doubt, is going to inspire quite a lot of young people out there.
I hope so. If we can have more women in politics. Absolutely, more women in law, absolutely. I'll be so happy.
We wish you all the very best.
Thank you.
We thank you for your being very candid, and we wish you the very best for 2020.
Thank you.
Now let me turn to our viewers out in the diaspora, on the continent and in Zimbabwe. We hope you enjoyed that conversation. There's lots more where this came from. And we invite you to go to our YouTube channel, press onto the subscribe button so that you get an alert every time we have a show. Remember, In Conversation with Trevor is a weekly show. You don't want to miss out. So until next time, See you. Cheers.